in economics, the same questions come up often and again, because they cannot be resolved in the way that the past becomes relatively unimportant. They're never dismissible, but they could be close to being not immediately relevant at all in the context of some subjects where past ideas have been totally rejected. But you see, when you're dealing with, and this applies more to philosophy and to political philosophy in particular than to pure economics, if you're dealing with such ideas as the idea of justice, which has occurred again and again in the world, and people have taken different views on it, between, say, Plato or Aristotle, or looking elsewhere, say, in India, Kautilya, they have come up in different ways at that time, and they still remain relevant. And therefore, the history of political philosophy is of considerable interest to contemporary political philosophy. And in a kind of somewhat similar way, the history of economics is relevant to economics today, because some of the issues have not been fully resolved. Now, we know a lot more about how a market economy works. We know also a lot more how a large global economy with international trade in a huge variety of commodities works. We know about that because we have seen such an economy. We live in such an economy. On the other hand, at the time when Smith was writing, he was speculating to a great extent about what the world would look like if there was widespread trade. Now, it's amazing, of course, that he did get most of his expectations were. I mean, he did get most things right. Indeed, most of his expectations were extremely cogently worked out. And it shows the power of reasoning to be able to theorize about something which he hasn't yet seen. But I think that's also one of the things why we study history, because there have been really exceptional thinkers, of which Adam Smith is a major example, but I think John Stuart Mill would be another example, Karl Marx would be another example. Some of my friends would regard David Ricardo to be like that too. I don't really think that, because I think Ricardo's views were more limited, and my judgment, it is not as foundational as Smith's writing. Yes, I could recall his history. Thank you for asking. It's very nostalgic for me. I was interested in moral and political philosophy in addition to social choice theory. But, of course, social choice theory was becoming my main interest beginning from the early 1960s. I wanted to work on social choice theory even earlier when I was in Calcutta. And in fact, my friend Sukumar Chakravarti drew my attention to Kenneth Arrow's book, Social Choice and Individual Values, about 6 months after it was published. So it was quite early days. And I remember struggling with it, thinking that that proof must be simplifiable, because it seemed a gigantically complicated proof. But then again, the main thing about it was that it was an absolutely stunning theorem. And it immediately became my example, and that's the main way I used it in Calcutta. When somebody, I was doing economics and math, and some people were very unsympathetic to it, and they will sometimes ask me a question, can you give me an example of some result of mathematical economics that is significant, but which you could not have guessed on the basis of informal reasoning? Yeah. My answer was the impossibility theorem. I couldn't guess it, and I don't think anybody could easily expect a result of that kind without actually going through the proof of it, because at the end of it, you ask, where was the mistake? And the answer is, there wasn't. That is the result. And so I was familiar with that. But then when I went to Cambridge from there, first of all, they were very against mathematics and economics. So I unlearned many things I knew as someone studying economics and math in Calcutta, but also in the sense I didn't use them and put them away. But the secondly, I they were very unsympathetic to social choice theory. And in fact, some of them were extremely hostile. Joan Robinson was very hostile to it. She thought I was taking time away from really important problems in the world, which for her was growth and capital theory. Now, I found their position quite implausible, because while growth is important, surely we knew that poverty doesn't have so much, poverty doesn't depend only on growth, it depends on many issues like distribution. And welfare economics of distribution was a total mess, because after the decline of utilitarianism in welfare economics, which took place in the 1930s, and I was a student in Cambridge in between 53 and 55 doing my degree there, undergraduate degree there, there was almost nothing on in distribution. And oddly, even though people who were very critical of the utilitarian perspective, like Maurice Dobb, but very interested in inequality, as he was as a left-wing thinker, he was a Marxist, indeed a member of the British Communist Party, but he, since he was involved in inequality, he had a natural sympathy for the social choice problematique. Mm-hmm. Not so much Arrow's book, because it doesn't go to inequality at all. It gets stuck. I mean, that there's an interesting issue there, because I think Arrow, knowing his political views and convictions, even at that time when he was a student in City College in New York, mm-hmm. he would have been interested in inequality. But if you start with some very elementary proposition and you generate an impossibility result, you don't ask the question, how can I add another thing, condition to it, namely inequality aversion, because that the system is already overdetermined. Mm-hmm. So he got shunted off. And when I was reading Arrow, other than seeing the beauty of the result and the beauty of his kind of reasoning and mathematical reasoning, which also appealed to me because I always preferred relational algebra, mathematical reasoning, basically more connected with foundation of mathematics than with hugely complicated operations in differential geometry or differential algebra and so on. I did do some of those, but late 60s, I made some use of calculus of variations and Pontryagin, who was then quite a rage in the mid-60s in the world that I knew. But basically, my love was much more for mathematical logic. And Ken Arrow made such wonderful use of that. However, I did think that there is something to be said about justice and inequality in this world. So that became very much my engagement. And if there's a departure in my 1970 book, Collective Choice and Social Welfare, it is to try to make social choice theory more constructive, more able to deal with issues of justice, injustice, equality or inequality. And I was a follower of Ken Arrow. I still am a follower of Ken Arrow. On the other hand, I wanted to take the subject a bit away from the focus that he had given it. So in the middle of it all, 68, 69, I decided to visit Harvard. My friend Steve Marglin was in Delhi, and he said, would you like to visit Harvard? And I was teaching in Delhi, and I said, yeah. And then I gathered that Ken Arrow was coming. So Ken first wrote to me saying, shall we do a course together? I said, yes, I'd love to do that. He had read some of my papers then. I'd published a few articles in the Econometrica and elsewhere about consistency of majority decision and so on. But then Ken wrote saying, what about John Rawls? Because I had talked with him about John Rawls. And he said, well, I greatly admire what I've seen, though I don't agree with him. So I said, I don't agree with him also, but I think it would be wonderful if you want to really make it a joint course in Rawls Laws. And I said, most likely he would not agree. But then he wrote to me saying, Ken Arrow wrote to me like to Delhi saying, no, he agrees. So we decided to have that course. I thoroughly enjoyed it, learned a tremendous amount, both from what Ken Arrow said and what John Rawls said. John Rawls had a manuscript which would later become his book, A Theory of Justice. We discussed that. And I benefited as much from Rawls's criticism of my own manuscript, Collective Choice and Social Welfare, which he read from beginning to end, as I was also from reading his own book and my conversations with him, saying, why do you say that? Why do you say this? And he told me why he thought I was mistaken in worrying about it, and so on. So this was a very productive period for me. And my book, Collective Choice and Social Welfare, was completed here in Harvard. How did it come about? I knew three things, definitely. I knew that I was... I thought that some idea of freedom has to come into social choice theory. That is, if I manage to move social choice theory away from looking for new and new impossibility theorems, and wanted a constructive theorem, I would look not only for utility reflected in it, but freedom. And at that time, I did not make a sufficient distinction between freedom and rights. So it seemed to me freedom, liberty, rights, kind of standard thing. I mean, if you take clue from the French Revolution, which is, as you can see, is quite big in the book. I know the French Revolution is no longer popular in France, but it's very popular with me. And so I thought that somehow liberty, equality, and fraternity all have to figure somewhere. But it was quite clear that in some ways none of them had figured in the utilitarian perspective, certainly not adequately. And I was working on utility in welfare, anyway, well-being, there's no way of avoiding that. But what about liberty, I kept on asking, and what about rights in general? And I was vaguely aware, and became increasingly more aware, of the French Declaration of the Rights of Man. I did not at that time pay as much attention to Mary Wollstonecraft as I should have. And if I had, it would have helped me, I think. But I knew that I had to get right in somewhere. So that's one thought. So that was certainly, I was looking for something where I put in right. But my second thought was that there has to be some kind of a problem in integrating liberty with utility, because they push you in different directions. A conflict of which John Stuart Mill was very aware. So did John Stuart Mill figure in my mind? Yes, he did. But he, of course, did not think that there was a unmanageable conflict there. And he found an equilibrium to his own satisfaction, which would accommodate utility as well as liberty. And that's what, in some way, the book on liberty does. I wasn't certain that was the case. I was worried that it seemed to me that Mill is a big figure in my life, but his way of avoiding it is not a good way. Because basically, I think the best way of thinking about it, as I think Richard Wolheim made clear in a very important paper, that you have to think of a world where everybody is a utilitarian. There will be no violation of liberty. And he gave complicated reasoning for it. Now, whether or not that reasoning works, it seemed to me that's a different problem. The world in which we live, not everyone is going to be utilitarian. And there will be pro-utilitarians, anti-utilitarians, pro-liberty, anti-liberty. In the world in which we live, there could be conflict of utility and liberty, and I was worried about that. So the third point I've come to was that I was looking for not an impossibility result. I was looking for a possibility result, integrating liberty with utility. But, you know, I think that that theorem is far less interesting and important than Arrow's impossibility theorem. But there is a similarity between what happened to me and what had happened to Ken Arrow. Namely, Ken Arrow, pioneeringly, and he's our guru of us all, was looking for a constructive social choice theory and got stuck with the impossibility. And then, in some ways, I mean, this is not a complaint against him, the subject got stuck there because it seemed so implausible. You may remember, after Arrow's impossibility theorem came in, there was a whole sequence of theorems with a small sequence of writing saying the theorem is mistaken, this mistaken, and there was a very tiny little mistake somewhere which Blau got very involved with, and you know, that could be plugged, and it was plugged. But it was good, he was right, that there was a thing. But there was no way that the insight of the theorem were wrong. But we had to go beyond that. But Ken made some gesture to it in his 1963 edition by drawing on the writings of Patrick Soupy's and what he called extended sympathy. But that was pretty ad hoc. It's not an approach, really. Ken Arrow knew that, but you know, he was just saying, well, maybe this is the one way of proceeding. In my case, I was also got stuck in a similar way. I was trying to get liberty and equality, not so much utility, but liberty and well-being. Not the same thing as utility necessarily, excepting in one limited perspective. I was trying to accommodate the two of them. And I was hoping very much for a constructive theorem. But then I got stuck at a theorem which seemed difficult, but also immensely simpler than the Arrow impossibility theorem. You can give a 4-line proof of that. Basically, you can give a 20-line proof even of Arrow's theorem now. And by that, I don't mean theorem that derive on other results. Those short proofs I don't buy. You can give an elementary proof that is very short of Ken. But it's still several times as large as the proof of the impossibility of Bayesian liberal. So there I was. There were two of them were constructive search. The third was a disappointment. I didn't manage to get there. But then by the time I got used to it, I had some very early things on that in Delhi before I came here. And then I gave it here to Ken Arrow to look at. And Leo Hurwitz was visiting. And Leo Hurwitz looked at that. And Tom Schelling was here. He looked at that. And I got long letters from all of them on the impossibility of the Pareteian liberal. I think Tom Schelling's was, I don't know, a long, like 8-10-page letter. And then it occurred to me, my God, there must be something of importance if all these people are so worried about it. Oh, and the other I'm not mentioning, Robert Dorfman was very interested in that. Dorfman. Yeah. And so then I thought that I ought to do something about it. And so when I sent the article to Journal of Political Economy, I wasn't certain whether they would publish it. It was a short article, only a few pages. I had no idea they would generate a huge literature. And I do know that it was refereed by two persons, one of whom was Milton Friedman. And he didn't like my work very much. In fact, the Swedes made a movie called That Other Prize, which is economics novel, you know, later edition. And there's quite a lot of it is Friedman versus me. And while I'm not interviewed on Friedman, Friedman is interviewed on me, where he says, what he does is very interesting, but this isn't economics, you know. It's something quite different. I have nothing. And he said, there's nothing wrong with it. He wants to do it. He can do it. But I don't call it economics. And he was totally consistent, because he wasn't saying it was bad. Indeed, he wanted the paper to be published. And but for Milton Friedman's referee, I think it probably wouldn't be published. But it was published. But the I mean, he just kept on saying that this has nothing to do with economics. That view I respect, but I don't agree with. But then, of course, came the huge, gigantic literature on that. And then I got stuck. And then I had to rescue myself, that I'm not concerned only with the Platonic liberal. Just as right now, I have to rescue myself by saying, I'm not a capability theorist. For God's sake, I'm not a capability theorist. I have great interest in capability. I had a role in bringing the discussion up in the contemporary political philosophy. But I don't think you can have a theory of justice based on capability only. There's no way. And so that question was there. So I got stuck with Peretian liberal in a way that it became a much bigger part of my life than I had first thought. Well, when I was examining my attitude to utilitarianism, I thought I was intrinsically unsympathetic to utilitarianism, and I asked myself, why was that the case? Part of the reason is very simple. Utilitarianism is not concerned with inequality and distribution, excepting indirectly. My second concern with utilitarianism was that I didn't think that utility in the sense of one's psychological pleasure or satisfaction, a la Marshall, or desire fulfillment, a la Ramsey, is a good way. Frank Ramsey.
Oh, all right, thank you.
Frank Ramsey.
Sure, I'm sorry.
Was a particularly good way of thinking about well-being. So there was that question. I didn't think it's a good measure of well-being. But then it occurred to me that even with the best measure of well-being, that can't be the only thing that you're looking. Because there could be other concerns, that sometimes people would willfully, cogently, and with reason sacrifice well-being for the sake of some other objectives. The objective could be political, like Mahatma Gandhi fasting for a political end. I don't think he thought that this was enhancing his well-being. And there would be a dialogue of the deaf if one of the rational choice theorists of the old school talked with Gandhiji and tried to tell Gandhi, why are you fasting? This is not advancing your well-being. And Gandhi would have said, that's not what I'm trying to do. And then the rational choice theorist would say, well, then you're making a mistake. And then Gandhi would say, no, that is what I want to do. And then the rational choice theorist would say, well, then that is your well-being. That is the way well-being is defined. That would be an entirely a dialogue of the deaf. And I didn't want the dialogue of the deaf. And because we do have other values. Sometimes we make sacrifice for others, not on grounds that would make us happier or more fulfilled or have a greater well-being, but because it's something I want to do, even at the cost of myself. And it did seem to me that therefore there has to be some idea of freedom, of capability, and related to it, the power to influence your life and lives of others in the direction in which you want to go. So welfareism captures total focus on total focus on well-being, one. Two, identifying well-being with utility, either pleasure or desire fulfillment. And three, without insisting that you have no concern about inequality or well-being. You could have. So well-being, welfareism is just that. But the question is, what could I call it? I couldn't call it utilitarianism. It already existed. I did toy with utilityism, but that sounded to me, economics generates some of the ugliest expressions ever known to humanity, but this seemed even uglier than the usual economics expression. So then I thought welfareism would do. I have to explain, because there are these two elements. Focus only on welfare, not in anything else like freedom and other objectives, and also your following rules, your concern for society, what Smith could call public-spiritedness. It has no room for that. And secondly, it takes well-being to be the same as psychological satisfaction or psychological fulfillment of desire. And so I could have called it utilitarianism, which is focused on the latter part, or welfareism, which is focused on the former part. But since utilitarianism sounded nasty, utilitarianism was already taken, I thought that welfareism would have to be it. That's how the term emerged. Now it's quite standardly used. I have sometimes students who come and explain to me what welfareism is. I'm very happy to hear it, because I want to. But I can still remember the time when I was toying with the idea as to what term to use for that. But the term has come to stay now. Well, you know, I think my interest in democracy, is that what you're asking? Yeah. Well, my interest in democracy is actually older than my interest in social choice theory. Because when I was a student in Calcutta, between 51 and 53, but in the Calcutta days I was very involved in politics, of a left-wing kind. Mm-hmm. But I had great difficulty with the standard left-wing position because of their skepticism of democracy. Because mainly it was very dominated by the communist way of thinking, which was quite hostile to the idea of democracy, dismissing it as bourgeois democracy, mm-hmm. and so on. And I found it completely unacceptable to take their position. I was at particular grumble with those who thought that the Arrow impossibility theorem either showed the impossibility of democracy or showed the impossibility of a democracy which pursues certain objectives. And in some ways, it only became clear gradually how close I was to Marquis de Condorcet in that, because he was a democrat. He believed in liberty. He wanted equality, justice, fraternity, and liberty, equality, and fraternity. And he, at the same time, wanted all the procedures of democracy, really. I've never seen democracy as just majority rule. Nor did Marquis de Condorcet ever. But I don't think democracy is only about individual preferences. The fact is that as human beings, we are individuals. There's no escape from the fact. But we don't live in isolation from others. And that's why collective choice and social welfare begins with a quotation from Marx in page 1. What is to be avoided above all is the re-establishing of quote-unquote society as an abstraction vis-a-vis the individual. Mm-hmm. So I was very much taking the line that the individuals, we happen to be individuals, but we don't live in our own island. We're constantly influencing each other. And that's why also when people say that, well, your theory is very individualistic, I mean, there's no way that I am two persons. I'm not a community. I am who I am. I am a person with a limited lifespan, most of which, alas, I've led already. And that's me. And when I die, I go. And it's, society may live on, but that doesn't mean that I live on. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that I am in some ways independent of society. There can't be. So there can't be any methodological individualism in this approach, if it's properly defined. And yet, there is an individual concentration here in the sense that it is the voices of people that you have to listen to, and people consist of a whole lot of individuals. So it's that thing. Now, democracy is a wonderful way of understanding the connections, because, as Condorcet in particular discussed, that our understanding of what we ought to do changes through public discussion. And democracy is quintessentially parasitic on, or dependent on public discussion. Condorcet was one of the great theorists of public discussion in the 18th century. So I think in the democracy context, it's not the concept of the individual, but it's the concept of the interdependent individual that you're looking at. And you cannot say how a person would behave without seeing it in a social context.
Okay.
How are you going to put all this in? I just don't know.
Yes,
I wish. Well, you don't know either.
Okay, good, very good.
But we'll have to manage because he's going to want us to give him.
Yeah. Rialto at 8 o'clock?
Yes, 8 o'clock.
Charles Hotel. Jacqueline?
Yes.
Do you think you could kindly print out a map with Charles Hotel in it?
Sure. Is it near here?
It's about 8 minutes walk from here.
Okay.